Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. We're doing things a little differently tonight. We're going to go deep on three different news stories. We'll learn about San Francisco's newest police chief, Derek Liu, and then we'll talk about the strange weather we're having. At the end of the hour, we'll hear from author Mary Alice Stevens, who has a new book about living without alcohol. But first, Northern California has long been synonymous with great wines. It's a $55 billion industry, and after a boozy pandemic period, things have changed for the wine industry. What does that mean for the Bay Area? I'm so pleased to be joined by Esther Mobley. She's the senior wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle, and she's going to help us understand what the prospects are for this vital Bay Area industry. Welcome to State of the Bay, Esther.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. And a quick note to our listeners, our phones will be open all the way through. So if you want to call and offer comments or suggestions or questions, it's 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Esther, at the beginning of this year, you predicted 2025 would be the year of the California winery closure. Were you right?
Unfortunately, yes. We've seen a lot of wineries shut down this year in the Bay Area, or sell or close down some aspects of their operations. Some have just closed tasting rooms, but kept their brands going. So we're really seeing the effects, and I suspect we're going to see more of that going into 2026.
What's causing these wineries to close down?
There's several things that are contributing to this crisis that the California and really the global wine industry is experiencing right now, which is really a kind of generational crisis. The wine industry in the US grew really steadily for about 30 years. So every year, wine consumption was growing, the industry grew. And now in the last couple of years, really since we've come out of the pandemic, there's been a shift downward for the first time in that, you know, many people who work in this industry have ever seen. So there's some structural things that have led to this. California in particular planted too many wine grapes in the late 2010s. And by the time they can actually see the results of that, you know, a vineyard takes a few years to mature, and then the wine takes a few years before it's ready to sell. The market didn't really keep up with the pace at which the industry was growing. So we've had this surplus of grapes that's led to all kinds of other problems in the market. At the same time as that's been happening, wine consumption and all alcohol consumption, it's really not just wine, has been declining. You probably know many people in your life who are cutting down on drinking or cutting out entirely. And then several other things, like as you mentioned earlier, COVID kind of distorted the market for a little while, and everyone thought their sales were going to be rising for a long time. And so wine producers really increased their production, only to find that the frenzied alcohol buying habits that many people showed during early COVID did not continue. Climate change is a big issue, and there's been several years of major wildfires that have really impacted the industry, including this year in Napa. So those are just a few of the reasons that wine producers and wine growers are struggling.
Do you think, I mean, there's so many things at play here, consumer tastes and climate change and the like. Is there any hope in sight for the industry? How is it responding and trying to bounce back from these obstacles?
I think there's a lot of hope for the industry. And I think what we're seeing, and what I was trying to get at when I wrote earlier this year that this is going to be the year of California winery closures, is that there's, to some degree, I think there's a kind of healthy industry shakeout happening, where there's a lot of wineries that probably weren't really set up to withstand, you know, a long business trajectory. And those are the ones that probably aren't going to survive. There's a lot of wineries in California that were started because people were just passionate about wine and had some disposable income and may not have really set it up like a business that's meant to last. And so I think what we may see out of this is a slightly leaner wine industry, but one where the businesses that make it are you know, really have an identity, have a really high quality product, have kind of something distinctive and something interesting to say. So that's what I'm hoping will come out of this. But there may be a lot of folks who hurt in the process.
Well, you know, like any industry, there's so much segmentation in the wine industry. There's the very fancy wines that you hear of that go for $500 a bottle, like a bottle of Screaming Eagle. And then there's your, you know, your box wines, you know, for all those lovers of Franzia out there, you know, those are fine too. When it comes to that, you know, the spectrum of wines that are out there, does the Bay Area's wine industry speak to all of those, or, you know, do most of the grapes that go into lower quality wines come from the Central Valley?
It's really hard to make a really serious value play in the Bay Area just because the cost of doing business is so high here. And I will note Screaming Eagle is closer to $1,000 a bottle now.
Scary.
Yeah, pretty wild, pretty scary. So yeah, I mean, you know, those of us who live in the Bay Area are familiar, just as it's not cheap to buy a property here or to hire workers here. It's, you know, all of those things are at play. And yeah, in a place like Napa Valley, the cost of things and the market for grapes has grown astronomically. I do think there's an opportunity in this moment of crisis for there to be some shifting on that. And I personally believe that presenting a better value proposition is going to be crucial for the wine industry to appeal to new drinkers, and especially to capture younger drinkers who we keep hearing are not drinking wine as much as previous generations were. So I think folks are going to have to figure out a different way to do it. But I don't, you know, I think the issues seem really intractable. Yeah, most of the kind of cheap wine that you see on supermarket shelves that sells for $7, $8 a bottle or less, mm-hmm. if it's coming from California, it's coming from usually the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's possible that some of the grapes that went into it didn't come from California at all. They may be imported from all kinds of other parts of the world, really. So that's not coming from Napa and Sonoma for the most part.
Well, how are tariffs affecting winemakers' ability to export their wine? You know, I've read that Canadians are like, we're not going to be drinking your American wine anymore. So what's that impact been?
Yeah, the retaliatory effects of the tariffs have been extreme for California wine growers and winemakers. So Canada, which was the single largest export market for California wine, has boycotted California wine. Now, has boycotted American wine, I should say. It's not specific to California. And that's just had a huge effect. And just today, there were two interesting updates from Washington, one of which was noted in the NPR news update we just heard. But the Trump administration announced a $12 billion program to provide bridge payments to farmers to offset the effects of these tariff retaliations. Of that $12 billion, only $1 billion is earmarked for specialty crop producers, which would encompass wine growers. And some industry experts I spoke with today said they don't really anticipate that making a drop in the bucket. $1 billion might sound like a lot, but spread across all of the specialty crop producers in America, that's not going to be much.
Yeah.
But a group of Congress people, including the Bay Area's Congressman Representative Mike Thompson, also introduced a bill today that would help wine growers and other specialty crop producers in the wake of tariffs by doing things like buying surplus crops to serve in school lunches, although I don't think there's going to be much place for Cabernet grapes in school lunch boxes.
It would be an upgrade, that is for sure. Well, a listener writes here, during the pandemic, I went the opposite direction of a lot of people and stopped drinking alcohol. Now it seems the rest of the world is catching up. Is the industry looking at non-alcoholic wine as a possible mainstay? Judging from prices I see at restaurants, it seems the price is no different than wine with alcohol.
Yes. I mean, everyone in the wine industry is scrambling to figure out how to make a really good tasting non-alcoholic wine. I have not yet had one that really tastes that great. It's tricky because alcohol in wine does a lot more than just add an intoxicant. it adds all kinds of things to the mouthfeel of the wine, to it, you know, helps you smell the wine more acutely. So if you've had, you know, your listeners may have had some of these non-alcoholic wines that taste really plasticky and artificial and are just not very appetizing, but there's a lot of research and development being put into figuring out how to do it better. And I suspect that in a couple of years, it may take a couple of years, but I suspect that we're going to see really, really just much improved efforts. And for what it's worth, I think that non-alcoholic beer is a lot further ahead. I think you can get much better non-alcoholic beer right now than non-alcoholic wine.
I think I agree with that. I think that is very, very true. One last question about the industry itself. I mean, obviously, any agricultural industry does rely a little bit on immigrant labor. How much has ICE activity and the Trump administration's statements about immigrant labor impacted wine growers?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really big ongoing question for the wine industry, which does run, it depends hugely on immigrant labor. And I don't have any firsthand accounts to share here, but we've heard that there have been situations where workers are not showing up to work during the peak of the harvest season because they're afraid of ICE activity. And there's certainly generally just a kind of culture of fear that is pervading the industry. So it's a big question. And as with all agricultural sectors, folks don't really know what's coming next or what it's going to look like.
Well, I can't let you leave without offering us a recommendation. So from Esther Mobley, what should we be drinking?
Well, there's so much great California wine out there right now. And wow, it would be hard to pin some down. So if you're in the East Bay, one of my favorite wineries is Brock in Berkeley, BROC. They make beautiful wines, a really wide range of styles, very accessible prices. They're really fun. You don't have to drive all the way up to proper wine country to enjoy some really good wines.
Well, I think that is a great recommendation, Brock in Berkeley. And I want to thank you for joining us. That was Esther Mobley, senior wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much, Esther.
Thank you.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk about the unusual weather we're experiencing right now. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
This week on Bay Made, we are proud to share Tales from the Bus from the Muni Diaries podcast. Since 2008, thousands of people have contributed online and at live events to what feels like a collective love letter to this place we call home. So tune into Bay Made all week at 11:30 a.m. for stories from Muni Diaries, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Experience 50 years of social justice poster art produced in the Bay Area. This is Suni Khalid. Join me Tuesday, December 9th for the opening of our new art show, Mission Graphica, The People's Voice. I'll be talking with Martina Ayala, Executive Director of the Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts, about how community art can power creative resistance. It's happening tomorrow at 6 o'clock at 220 Montgomery Street. Find more info at kalw.org/events.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. In case you haven't noticed, it has been very cold in the Bay Area lately. At the end of November, the cold weather broke a 102-year-old record. Greg Porter is the senior newsroom meteorologist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he says our weather system is stuck. And he's here tonight on State of the Bay to explain all of it to us. Welcome to State of the Bay, Greg.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, we'll get to the specifics of our stuck weather a little bit later. But oftentimes this time of year, we're debating, are we in an El Nino year? Are we in a La Nina year? So where are we, Greg, in terms of that?
Yeah, great. It's a big topic, of course. And this is something that actually we covered a few weeks ago. So technically, we are in a La Nina year, which, you know, historically means that a bit of a wetter, cooler pattern for California. Now, California is a big state, so that isn't necessarily across the board. It's not a uniform sort of outcome, more towards Northern California versus Southern California. However, I'll caveat that with saying a few things. It's a weak La Nina. It's sort of a weak episode, and it's one that's expected to sort of end in a few months. And on top of that, we covered this a little bit in a story we did a few weeks ago, but you know, La Nina and El Nino don't necessarily mean what they used to mean, I think, from the public perception. So while I think a lot of, El Nino sort of came into people's minds in the 90s and 97 when that, really, really wet year happened, it turns out partially because of climate change that, La Nina and El Nino don't necessarily mean what they meant before in terms of outcomes for California, but it is technically a La Nina.
Well, it's such a cute way to talk about the weather. So I think it really grabs people's minds. So, it has been really cold and very dry in the Bay Area. Is that unusual? I mean, I mentioned in the intro that we broke this 102-year-old record, but it was the difference between 50 degrees and 51 degrees. So, it sounds spectacularly like, wow, we broke a record, but it doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
It's a San Francisco record, right? It's a classic San Francisco weather record where you see that number, you're like, wow, 100 years. But yeah, it's a difference of 1 degree. And I mean, that has everything to do with the proximity of the water, right? The water really regulates the temperature on here, but it has been cold. It has been absolutely cold. And it's been a bit of a sort of a reversal of the typical pattern. Central California, Sacramento Valley, Central Valley, and extending into parts of the East Bay and North Bay, these are places that bake during the summer, right? They get up to 100 degrees regularly, and we're usually pretty cool here in the city. And it's been a reverse. So we've had this really, really cool, pervasive, totally fog pattern. That's, Sacramento hasn't really seen the sun, I think, in probably 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And that's sort of dripped over to the Bay Area as well. I think, we're not getting as much of the same sort of, cool cloud, as they're getting in the Central Valley, but it has been cool. It's not exceptionally cool, but I think in the last 2 weeks, pretty much every region is having, maybe a top five kind of coolest stretch from November to December, depending on, climatic records at different stations. So it's definitely been cool.
Well, for people, we often talk about tule fog, and tell us a little bit about what that fog is and why that's different than fog.
Yeah, so the radiation fog, and it's kind of driven by what that means is it's sort of driven by temperature differences between the Earth's surface and the atmosphere above it. And we'll talk a little bit about the suck pattern. Like you said, the part of the reason that this particular tule fog event is so pervasive is because what we call an inversion. So usually the temperature, cools as you go up higher in the atmosphere. When you have cool air that's stuck below warm air, that's an inversion. That's kind of what's going on right now. And you can actually see it pretty clearly in the difference between Sacramento, which has been stuck in the upper 40s, in Tahoe, which has been in the 60s, complete reverse, right? So that warm air is basically trapping, the cool air. And usually, that's not particularly atypical in December. Tule fog happens in this time of year. Part of that is because the sun angle is so low. We don't have a lot of solar insulation, so it sort of, recirculates itself. But this one's been particularly pervasive because the inversion is being reinforced a little bit by like a high pressure ridge, what we usually call high pressure, that big H you see on a weathered map. Mm-hmm. It's driving the difference between the temperature at the surface and the temperature aloft. And it's basically just it's a really thick tule fog layer. I think it's 1,000-2,000 feet, and it's just not going away. And it's actually so pervasive. It's dripped into the Bay Area. And as somebody who does forecast weather, my temperature forecast for this weekend was completely off. I was off by like 15 degrees in Santa Rosa and in Vacaville.
No weather person likes to admit that, but thanks for coming clean, Greg. Thanks for coming clean.
It's part of the job. It's okay.
Well, I mean, I was just remarking on the fog, the tule fog, because I was driving outside of the city up in Sonoma this weekend, and I just came upon it. I'm like, I can't see right in front of me, and I'm not in the Central Valley, so it felt very strange. But let's talk about this stuck weather pattern. What is exactly happening, and what will it take to get it unstuck?
That's a good question. So yeah, when we talk about the suck weather pattern, we're kind of, look at it from a high level, right? The weather the atmosphere generally wants to flow, wants to move. It's a fluid. It's what we call kind of a fluid dynamic. So it wants to move basically from west to east, but it oftentimes will get blocked up. So there'll be sort of semi-permanent, basically pressure patterns that develop and kind of block weather patterns. Block the typical sort of west to east flow, and that's essentially what's going on really across the Northern Hemisphere right now. You may have, our friends back east are experiencing a pretty cold start to December. Some places are even getting snow in North Carolina, Virginia, that don't typically get snow in December. And that's very much related to what's going on out here. It's cold in the east, and it's warm, allegedly warm, not in the places we talked about. It's if you look at the rest of California, it's warm. It's stagnant. It's a stagnant pattern that almost sort of reinforces itself. It's what we call sort of a standing wave pattern. I won't get into the too much specifics, but it's something that, it takes a lot to sort of break it down. And once it gets put in place, it's stuck. And this pattern's been in place for, at this point over a week, and it's going to be in place for another, at least 7 days.
Is this climate change at work, or is this typical, or does this happen every so often?
So climate change definitely plays a role. It's there's no doubt about it. I think there's no way to ignore some of the sort of intangibles. Specifically the ocean, it's a complicated sort of relationship between ocean dynamics and atmospheric dynamics. But, the warm ocean waters in the Pacific is warm, quite warm. We've heard about this warm blob now for many years, definitely plays a role in the pressure patterns that develop over the Pacific. It's so I would say, broadly speaking, yes, of course, it's absolutely because of climate change. Really hard to give a specific attribution to this event and say, aha, this is we're getting this weather in December of 2025 because of climate change. We can't really drill down like that, but broadly speaking, yes. Things when things don't behave as we thought they used to behave, there's a reason for that, right?
Well, looking at the records, November was unusually wet. There was a lot of rainfall here in the Bay Area, and now it's just been so dry. We haven't had rain for quite a little bit of time. And, for people who are worried about wildfires, who want to see snow up in Tahoe, is this dry December also typical, or is this something to say, this is very unusual?
So it's not in the unusual state yet. I actually wrote about this morning. We've in San Francisco, we haven't had any rain in 17 days. And the Weather Service actually office put out a great stat earlier today and saying, in the last, 150 years in November and December, we've averaged about 25% chance where we get these kind of extended stretches, like 2 to 3 weeks of dry weather in our typically rainy season. So it's not abnormal, but a couple of things are making it, a bit eye-opening. I think one of them is what you mentioned in the Sierra, the lack of the snowpack in the Sierra. Again, not something that it's been trending that way recently. They don't get as much early snow, and most of the snow falls, January, February, March anyways. But we were just talking about it today. Some of the stations up there are reporting their, all-time record low snow depth right now. There's just no snow up there, even at high elevations. So that's particularly eye-opening. The Central Sierra Snow Lab, which has been keeping snowball records since the late 1880s, well below their average for right now. So that's something to consider. And it actually, ironically enough, that sort of lack of snowpack in the Sierra actually kind of drives a little bit. It's a feedback mechanism for that tule fog that we talked about. The lack of cold air sort of being able to drain into the Central Valley actually helps reinforce that cloud cover. So you can say that it's playing a bit of a role in that.
It's like all the bumper stickers you see up in Tahoe, pray for snow. I guess that's a true thing. Yeah. Well, we have a listener who writes, this listener says, how much has the science of meteorology been affected by cuts made by the Trump administration? Has it made it harder to accurately predict the weather? I guess this person's referring to the cuts made by with NOAA. And how is that affecting your job at all?
Yeah, it definitely is. I think I rely, as somebody who does weather forecasting and in a media role, right? I rely heavily on the National Weather Service, in particular our local offices, and they're great partners with us. They put out amazing information, and they've been hit particularly hard with these cuts. They're short-staffed. They're not able to produce as many products or discussions as often as possible. This weekend was a great example. I think the Sacramento office in particular has been operating on, you know, understaffed by 2 or 3 people now since the summer. So they've had a cut down on how often they can update their products. So it definitely impacts, you know, us from a standpoint. During the shutdown, I would say it was actually even more impactful because we actually saw some of the data sources that I use on a regular basis just go dark. They just weren't being maintained. And so, yeah, it's definitely had an impact.
Well, before we let you leave, I think we need, what's your weather forecast for the next 10 days, Greg? Do I need to bring an umbrella or a scarf?
No umbrella needed. This is an easy one. Next 10 days, well, it's the stuck pattern, right? So we're going to be, I'm writing about it tomorrow morning, but basically we don't see any chance of rain, significant rain in our area until at least December 16th. And even at that point, you know, we're not looking at these major storms right now. So it's much of the same. We call it a persistence forecast in weather. You know, it's easy for us forecasters because we just say, you know, if you like the weather today, it's going to be like that tomorrow. So expect much of the same for the next week or so.
Well, we will come back to you if that changes. Thank you so much. So bundle up, everybody, according to Greg Porter. Greg is the senior newsroom meteorologist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much for joining us, Greg.
Thank you.
Next up, we're going to give you the down low on San Francisco's newest police chief. That's Derek Liu. Stay with us. But first, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. If you have anything to share about the current segment or anything discussed on the show tonight, let us know. You can call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So we're going to move straight to our next segment, which is this. Last week, Mayor Daniel Lurie appointed a new police chief following the departure of longtime police chief Bill Scott, who left in June to head up LA's Metro Transit Public Safety Unit. Jonah Owen Lamb of the San Francisco Standard is here to tell us all about the new chief and what his appointment means for the city and for Mayor Lurie, who ran on a more law and order platform. Welcome back to the State of the Bay, Jonah.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Jonah, tell us about Derek Liu. How long has he been on the force? Who is he?
Liu is a veteran. He's been with the department about 20 years. He's been a patrol officer. He has even been involved in a pretty high-stake shooting where his jacket was shot through and his partner ended up killing the man who fired the shot, who was actually London Breed's cousin, of all things. He is from San Francisco. He grew up in the Richmond. His grandparents came here from southern China and opened up a store. So he's, you know, the descendant of immigrants. But he's not really been a cop with, like, you know, a big name in the department. I mean, his relatively quick elevation from captain to deputy chief 6 months ago is quick compared to most folks who become chief. He was captain of Ingleside Station just a couple years ago, so he doesn't have a lot of management experience, and he was elevated under the interim chief, Paul Yep, who was a Lurie appointment. And Yep has, in the time that he's been here as this interim figure, he's reorganized the department and created a new command staff. So the department that he created and the command staff that he created is the one that Liu's gonna take over. So that's kind of the basics of his bio and kind of who he is and what we know about him.
Well, the way you have described him suggests that while he has kind of experience with the police force, it's sort of a surprise that he was appointed to this position. Is that how you look at it?
Yes and no. So my sources have been telling me, you know, Liu is the guy for months now. And of course, you know, I didn't know that for sure. But there's other things to remember, right? You know, we've only had 3 Asian chiefs in the history of the department. And so he's the 3rd permanent chief. So, you know, Lurie got voted into office. The big part of the electorate that voted for him was, you know, Chinese San Francisco. And so, you know, there's some of the ethnic politics that are at play here, I think, for sure. Also, he's, you know, an insider. We've had Scott, who is from LAPD for, you know, a really long time. I mean, unprecedented numbers in recent history in terms of the time he led the department. And so it was obvious, everyone had a sense that the new chief, whoever they were going to be, was going to be an SAPD veteran. And and all the candidates that went to the mayor that the police commission forwarded were veterans. In that way, I just to kind of point out here why he is maybe important, I think in other ways he looks like he's a cop's cop, right? He did patrol, he did investigations, he's done undercover stuff, right? He's, you can look at him is if you're a patrol officer or you're in the homicide unit or you're doing SVU and go, you know, this guy understands what I've done. So I think that there's a big role to play in terms of his own time in the department too.
Yeah, so has his appointment been received well by the force's rank and file?
Yeah, obviously there's always sections of the department that have their own, you know, kind of cliques and their own opinions, and every cop has a different opinion on every other cop. But I mean, I think more or less it's a good appointment. They're happy about this. They look at the guy and they go, you know, he's the guy I could follow. And I think the other candidates, either they didn't have the kind of personal gravitas or the experience on the street that, you know, most cops look to as a thing that kind of drives them towards wanting to follow somebody.
Well, this is a high stakes appointment for Mayor Lurie, and, you know, a lot of ink has been spilled on the, I guess it's fair to say, the snafu or even debacle of the District 4 supervisor appointment. So was there a lot of vetting being done here? I mean, did the police commission recommend Lou, or was that Lurie's choice?
Good question. So the way it works is that in the charter, the commission has the power to choose the three candidates to then give to the mayor, and then Lurie gets to choose. And if he doesn't like those three candidates, he can send the names back. So in this case, it was a, you know, months-long process. They hired a search firm. They got 34 candidates overall who applied for the role. And then they winnowed those down over a period of time, which included going out to at least 9 stations or districts to ask people what they wanted in a chief. So that in that way, you know, especially since the last the three finalists were all SFPD officers, we know about their histories, right? There's not like a lot of vetting that needs to be done here. Like, you know, I know he was involved in that shooting incident. We know there's a federal lawsuit that he was involved in that was dismissed, right? But other than that, like, he doesn't have a lot of skeletons in his closet, as far as we know. And I think, in terms of the mayor making this choice right after this debacle that the self fail that he did with the supervisor appointment, there was a lot already going for in terms of like the background that these folks had. So I don't think there was a lot to worry about there.
And what do we know from Derek Liu about what his agenda, his priorities will be? I mean, he has a pretty extensive background in drug enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, the last big role he had before he was appointed to deputy chief was running the DMACC operation, which is essentially like the city's center of, you know, street drug dealing policing. So I think that since the mayor, and any mayor, frankly, who would have gotten elected, would have had to concentrate on the drug dealing and drug use issue, I think this is his main priority. He did say when he was announced before the Hall of Justice last week with a bunch of cops up the steps, and, you know, it was a big scene. He said, you know, my priority is to make San Francisco the safest city in America. And frankly, the thing is that this city is crazy safe. I mean, look at the stats, you know, the murder rate, the violent crime rate. I mean, people might not like to see drug addicts or drug dealers on the streets, and, you know, fair enough, but like, when you look at the actual stats, what's actually happening in this town, like, this place is not violent. This place does not have crime compared to anywhere of our size across America. I mean, it's remarkable. So, like, while this is still a priority, and I know it's going to be a priority for the department, right, there are other issues, I think, that the department's going to have to deal with as well, in terms of, like, just making sure that cops, there's enough cops in the ranks, and those cops are staffing station houses, because I know some districts are pretty upset with the lack of enforcement in their area, especially when there's been this concentration in like the Tenderloin, Soma, and the Mission, when it comes to these drug issues.
Well, a listener asks, I like having a police chief who was born and raised in San Francisco. I think he understands the city better as a result. But I also understand that Chief Liu lives in Oakland. I know it's expensive to live here, but I do feel having a police chief who lives in the city would be better in terms of understanding what it means to live in San Francisco. Does Chief Liu live in Oakland, and does that matter?
He does not live in San Francisco, I can say that much. I think that there used to be this rule, I believe, that if you wanted to work in San Francisco, you as a cop, you had to live here. That is not the case anymore. I don't know if that necessarily matters. I mean, obviously, I understand the sentiment. You live here, you get a sense of what's going on. But if you grew up here, you're here every day. You know, you're talking to your officers, to your command staff, to get a sense of what's going on. I mean, you have a sense of what's going on. I think that the broader issue, though, in terms of like these insiders versus outsiders, these reasons why chiefs are chosen, I mean, I think it's often very political. It's not necessarily like, well, we have, you know, 100 people from across the country and there's someone who is just dynamite and they want to change things. You know, I think that it's important to think about that and also to remember that, like, you know, I don't think this mayor wanted a, you know, reformer or anybody to shake things up. I think that, you know, Lurie wanted a cop that was going to do police work, regardless if he lived in the East Bay or here. And I think it remains to be seen kind of how he's going to manage a department with more than 2,000 employees and like $800 million in budget when all he's done is run a police station and DMACC. But he's got a lot of good people around him, and I think that that's going to at least augur well from the start. But again, only time will tell.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, that the statistics on violent crime reflect that San Francisco is a relatively safe city to live in. You know, but there's still, I think, a sentiment that exists in the city, kind of the leftover feelings of the smash and grabs that have resulted in everything at every drugstore or Target to be locked up. The feeling that maybe you can't leave your backpack in your car because that might be prone to being taken as well. Tell me a little bit about the city in which Liu is inheriting in terms of that feeling like, well, it might be safe. I might not get murdered here, but I might like have my phone stolen or, you know, those sort of crimes. Yeah, exactly. You know, the crimes that make the quality of life here difficult.
I mean, again, all of those crimes are still going down. And I think I've been beating this dead horse since the end of COVID. There's always this major difference in terms of how people feel and the actual stats. And people always, you know, respond with, well, you know, people don't report all the crimes, so whatever you're saying isn't the real picture out there. Fair enough, but it's the only picture we have. So I just think it's also key to remember that you talk to any criminologist and rarely will they tell you this is why crime declined. The cops were out on the beat, crime dropped. You know, we know it dropped for this reason or that. And there's all these forces at work. We're coming out of COVID. You know, that was a traumatic event for everybody, right? Like how kids and the parents and people who had their families die. So it's really unclear why crime went up because it's all going down. I mean, I think that it's at least clear to look now that those numbers, you know, are coming down and coming down pretty quick across the board. So, you know, people are still thinking with that kind of sense of this is what's going on and this is a priority for me. So I understand, you know, I want people to be able to walk down the streets. I think everybody would say, you know, nobody should walk down the street in their neighborhood and feel unsafe. But the difference being like how they kind of perceive what's going on versus what's actually going on. And I think regardless of what the perception is, you know, the mayor and the new chief and the department are prioritizing like quality of life crime, right? The stuff that drove people to oust Chesa Boudin and elect this mayor in part and pass pretty kind of, you know, tough on crime kind of propositions that gave the police commission less power and, you know, empowered police after years of reform. So I think this is the world we live in. People feel this way, whether or not it's based on reality or not.
I wanted to ask you about that. You mentioned Chesa Boudin, but also, you know, the police chiefs can arrest people, but if the DA can't, you know, prosecute them and, you know, get the justice that people want, I mean, it's kind of like, what can the police do? So what has the response been from the DA's office, if we know, and how do we expect those two entities to work together?
I mean, the DA's office, I think, is in generally in lockstep with this approach to kind of being tougher on minor crimes on the streets. You know, obviously the DA gave, you know, the statement you would expect from the DA about a new chief congratulating Lou. I mean, I think the department and the DA's office have worked close together since Boudin was ousted. I don't think that there was any kind of, you know, remaining connection in terms of how they had dealt with each other when Boudin was the DA. Also, there's a huge bevy of people who have come to the DA's office from Alameda, when the DA over there was another progressive. So it was kind of refugees who came here. They've remained. They've kind of helped shape Brooke Jenkins' DA's office. And they're much more of a kind of tough on crime prosecutorial office than traditionally is the case in San Francisco. So I think they're obviously going to work together. But I think it's also important to note, like, some of the tactics that the police have been using, kind of like arresting lots of people for loitering and minor charges, you know, haven't resulted in charges all the time. Mm-hmm. So you have like dozens of people being arrested at parks who are either suspected drug dealers or suspected drug users. Then the DA gets them, the DA declines the charge, or they're just cited and released. Now, there's been an argument within kind of closed doors that says, well, this is a tactic that's used to kind of build a record of, say, loitering, and then you can finally charge people for like intending to do or sell drugs. But there is this question of, you know, you round a bunch of people up and then are they all going to get charged?
Yeah.
Or is it just a kind of like cycle? If you send them into jail, they walk out of jail, there's a minor charge, that kind of thing.
Hmm. Well, with the minute that we have left, Jonah, how will you in a year's time judge Lou as to whether he's done a good job, a fine job, a not so great job? What are the metrics that you'll be looking at?
So I don't actually think it's going to be about like what crime looks like, because like I said, I would never really blame the police chief for like crime rates going up or down, because I don't actually believe there's any evidence to show that like in a major way what they do affects that. I think how I would judge him is number one, how is he going to deal with the first major issue that arises, whether it's corruption in the ranks, the issue of dealing with Border Patrol or ICE on the streets of San Francisco. I mean, there are major issues that are going to be barreling down towards SF and SFPD that whoever was chief is going to have to deal with. And to me, it's more about how is he going to handle these issues that he didn't see coming, not the ones that are kind of obvious and like whoever's chief would continue to do the same thing. So there's those two topics. I also think that like really being a good communicator, I mean, we have to remember that like a police chief in San Francisco or any big city is kind of a politician. They're not elected, but they have to be the face of kind of representing law and order. They're like as important as the mayor almost. That's why I'm on your show, right?
Yeah, exactly.
For that reason. So if he's incapable of kind of sending a message to the public that he means business, that's going to also, I think, be an indication that he's failed on some level.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, and we'll bring you back in a year's time to see if Chief Lou has done a good job. Thanks for joining us, Jonah Owen-Lamb.
Thank you so much. I hope I come back before a year's time.
That's probably going to happen. Coming up after the break, author Mary Alice Stevens will talk about her new book, Uncorked. It's about her life without alcohol. We'll be right back.
Support for KALW comes from A Better Way, a nonprofit serving local children, youth, and families. Their team of mental health clinicians, parent advocates, and social workers aims to ensure parents and children have the support they need to succeed. More info at abetterwayinc.net.
This week on Bay Made, we are proud to share Tales from the Bus from the Muni Diaries podcast. Since 2008, thousands of people have contributed online and at live events to what feels like a collective love letter to this place we call home. So tune into Bay Made all week at 11:30 a.m. for stories from Muni Diaries, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. My guest tonight is Mary Alice Stevens, author of the new book Uncorked, a memoir of letting go and starting over. It's a clear-eyed look at what it means to quit drinking after years of building a life around it. Her book is both a personal story and a roadmap for anyone rethinking their relationship to alcohol. Mary Alice Stevens, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much.
First of all, congratulations on your new book and on over 14 years of sobriety.
Thank you. Both big bucket list items for me. So thank you.
Well earned. As you detail in your book, I know that transition to sobriety was not an easy one. You write about alcohol becoming your fairy godmother as a teenager. Tell us about what alcohol did for you in those early years.
Alcohol really pulled me out of my shell. I wanted to hang out with the cool kids at the parties, but I was so self-conscious. I just couldn't get outside of my head. So alcohol was like the silver bullet that just made me feel relaxed and fun and funny and flirty. But it came with consequences right out of the gate. I think the first time I drank was like a Bacardi and Coke, but a big gulp size. And I went to a party and out in a cornfield and had my first kiss and drank, and then wound up throwing up in the cornfield. And that's how my relationship with alcohol went for 30 years. It was like being in a toxic relationship with a boyfriend. There was the highs were so high and the lows were so low. But for a long time, alcohol really was fun for me. And it also started filling in the rough spots, like if I was sad or lonely, alcohol really soothed me in those moments. It made the highs higher and the lows bearable.
Yeah. And you also described this dramatic accident in Dublin in your 20s, where you fell nearly three stories and were in a body cast and in the hospital for weeks. And some people might have seen that as rock bottom, but you didn't necessarily stop drinking there. And can you talk about what that episode meant to you?
Yeah, I think many people who have a troubled relationship with alcohol can relate to this. Is we have a level of acceptance that we have a problem, but a stronger denial because we can't imagine giving it up. So we just justify all the time. We blame everything but the alcohol. So I had had three drinks before I made that dumb move to scale a wall to get to a party. Not realizing the other side was a big drop. But had I not been drinking, I would not have jumped over that wall in a dress at midnight in the rain, in the dark, you know? But I wasn't willing to face life without alcohol. So I just said that was just my mistake. And that was my theme. Anytime drinking really caused me problems, I was like, well, I'll get it right next time.
One of the turning points in Uncorked is this pool party where you make a joke about not wanting to put down your wine glass to save your son if he slips off the noodle in the deep end of the pool. And then you describe not remembering parts of the day. And the next morning, something shifts. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It wasn't a predetermined decision to quit drinking. I was playing this pros and cons game for probably the decade leading up to that. That the pros of alcohol continued to outweigh the cons, in my opinion, even though it was causing stress in my marriage, and even though it was putting my parenting in compromising positions. But that day was the first time I had gotten blackout drunk in front of my kids. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it, of course, in the moment, because that's what a blackout is. You're not able to process memories. So the next morning, I woke up and my husband wasn't in bed next to me for the first time. I was petrified that I just couldn't remember if I had fed the kids or not or put them to bed. Like the thought of being in that state in front of my kids really terrified me. Even though I knew my husband was there to take care of them, I still felt like that was a line in the sand for me. And I couldn't face my husband one more time apologizing. And I did not want anything tragic to happen with my kids on my watch. So that day was just a reckoning with myself and a decision like, this is exhausting. It's not worth it anymore. And I need to quit.
A lot of people are terrified that life without alcohol will be boring, joyless. This fear was something you express in the book as well. What did you find on the other side of that fear?
You know, I think my fears were grounded at the beginning. It was very difficult for me to socialize without drinking. I think I had five social occasions lined up that week I decided to get sober. And, you know, instead of canceling, I navigated them like white knuckling because I was so used to slipping into that calm and ease that alcohol gave me to be in social settings that I felt like I was walking into these parties like raw and naked. But I started going to a 12-step program and I saw a therapist and I really started to understand alcohol better and what alcohol does to you. And part of it is that it tricks your brain into thinking like, you're not going to have any fun without me. You're not going to get through the tough times without me. And so the more educated I got about it and the more grounded I got and developed some coping mechanisms, everything got easier little by little.
You said that you devoured sobriety memoirs in your first years of recovery, but you didn't always see your own story reflected. So you started writing this book, the book that you wished you'd had. What did you want Uncorked to do differently from other sobriety stories?
At that time, anyway, I felt like the sobriety memoirs were 80% about their life drinking and 20% about recovery. And I felt like they glossed over the recovery part. So the recovery story for me was the interesting and helpful part. So in my book, chapter one is my last drink and chapter two, I get sober. And So the story is those first raw days, weeks, and months of sobriety that have plenty of happy moments, but also all the difficult things that you used to numb, you now have to face.
Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, really seemed to work for you. What do you say to people who either don't believe in a higher power or think people can drink in moderation? Do you think there are other ways of getting sober?
I think there are lots of ways to get sober. I don't think moderation works. If someone has a problem with drinking, there's an expression, we couldn't control our drinking when we enjoyed it, and we couldn't enjoy our drinking when we controlled it. And regarding AA, it is very loosey-goosey on what they consider your higher power. Nature can be a higher power, or other sober people can be a higher power. And I think people get fixated on that because they're looking for an excuse not to try it. So My suggestion is just try it and make your own decision.
Well, let's talk about that. Every gathering this time of year seems to revolve around alcohol, cocktails, champagne. I mean, what are some practical tools from your own sober toolkit that listeners can use to get through a party or the season if they're trying to cut back?
Right. If you're going to a party, I would arrive late, leave early, have an exit strategy. If it's a party at somebody's home, I would bring your own non-alcoholic drinks to share, something that you're going to want to drink. For me, my go-to in the holidays is cranberry juice and club soda with a lime. And then just keep a drink in your hand. If somebody sees you with a drink in your hand, they're not going to question what's in it, you know, and they're going to just think you're one of them. And you can still have a stemmed glass, and that will make you feel festive. And then at these parties, have a sober ally. Have somebody you can confide in and say, hey, look, I'm trying to do this thing sober tonight, and then have somebody you can check in with.
All good advice. The book is Uncorked, a memoir of letting go and starting over. You can learn more about Mary at our website, stateofthebay@kalw.org, and find the book online or at your favorite local bookstore. Mary Alice Stevens, thank you so much for being on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much, Anne. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll talk about children and AI. Remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen, and you'll never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show is produced by Wendy Holcomb and Ann Harper. Our final segment was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.